rattling deep emotion. The wild, wild ocean. Yes, boss, the government has.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and this is Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a monthly program of author interviews and book reviews with a local perspective. And I'm your host, Chris Wilson. Today, we're going to be talking to Langdon Cook. He's an author, instructor, and lecturer on wild foods and the outdoors. He'll take you on a mushroom trip you won't forget. His books include the most recent book, Upstream, Searching for Wild Salmon from River to Table, The Mushroom Hunters, On the Trail of an Underground America, and also Fat of the Land, Adventures of a 21st Century Forager. I'd like to begin today with Langdon himself reading something from his first chapter.
If my first taste of salmon came at a young age, it wasn't until I was an adult that I actually saw a live one in the wild, in southwestern Oregon's Rogue River Canyon. I was in my early 20s, a born New Englander, recently relocated to the Pacific Northwest, new to salmon country. That year, I took a leave of absence from my schooling to caretake a secluded homestead in the coastal mountains, a couple of hours from civilization via rough forest roads. The owners of the homestead, two brothers, unlocked a pair of heavy steel gates, the sort that typically close off a logging road, to let me in. These gates might as well have opened up a new continent, a new dimension even. I entered the domain of bears, cougars, and salmon. The Rogue River is one of the few large watercourses left in the contiguous United States that isn't dogged by a road or highway for most of its length. In July, as the roadless canyon heated up, reaching triple-digit temperatures, the air heavy and nearly viscid, I swam daily in the Rogue to cool off. The trail to the river, built by a German-born mule skinner in the mid-1800s, dropped 800 feet in less than a mile through a fragrant grove of old-growth Douglas fir and Pacific madrone. My summer swims coincided with the upstream spawning migration of king salmon, which stacked up by the hundreds at creek mouths along the river course to rest and drink in the cold, highly oxygenated water that tumbles down from fir-clad mountains. Where a rushing tributary called Kelsey Creek marries its flow to the Rogue, I jumped off 20-foot cliffs into the river's refreshing embrace and paddled among the salmon that lingered around the creek mouth. Exhausted and lethargic from their journey, they didn't spook at my alien presence in the pool. 30-pounders finned right past me to reach the cool outflow, some of them brushing against my bare legs, their rippling sides exposing equal measures of strength and vulnerability. The Rogue River is where I first began to see the long-standing bond between people and salmon. The owners of the Wilderness Homestead gave me flies tied by their late father, a heart surgeon, and the gesture made me feel as though I belonged to a heritage that stretched back to a time before words could make sense of it. Every summer as boys, they had come to this remote canyon, and it was here that they had learned to fish, hunt, and travel through the backcountry. One became a high school biology teacher, the other an artist who models nature's elegant forms into his work. I was now a part of that tradition. In the fall, I walked the river trail every day in late afternoon as the sun slipped behind canyon walls, packing along my fly rod. The first time a fish rose off the bottom to take my feathered ruse, I was too surprised to set the hook. A swirl of quicksilver, and it was gone. Lucky for me, the fish hooked itself in its ardor, and I was attached to my first steelhead, the most prized game fish in the Northwest, a seagoing trout in the same family as Pacific salmon. The line between us went taut. It was a tether, both a connection to the past and a lead to the future. I've been chasing salmon ever since.
That's our author today who's joining us, I think, from Seattle by phone. Welcome, Langdon. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
I must say that I first saw this book in an independent bookstore in northern Wisconsin at the end of this summer. I was kind of surprised because I recognized your name, and I thought to myself, oh, a book about salmon. And then I've had the opportunity to read it, and I must say that this is a book that for those of you who are a little bit jaded and think you know everything about our keystone fish, you really don't, and you ought to pick up this book. From the back cover, it says, salmon are the essence of the Pacific Northwest, and as Langdon shows so powerfully, they are the key to the future. This is not a book that is going to depress you, but it is a book that's going to inspire you. So, Langdon, let's start where you start, a really exciting day, Copper River Day in Seattle, from the wholesaler to the chef. Tell us a little bit about why the Copper River Kings became so important to the seafood market.
Before I get to that, let me just say that the reason I start the book at Pike Place Market in Seattle is I wanted to start at the place where we have our most basic connection to these fish, which is at the marketplace. Mm-hmm. Some people are anglers. A few that I talk about in the book are commercial fishermen or tribal fishermen. And, you know, of course, there's scientists, environmentalists. So there are all sorts of people that have connections to these fish. But by far, the most common connection is just as an everyday consumer, buying a piece of salmon at the fish market. And so that's where I wanted to start, because there's an effect that these fish have on us. And it's almost like it's in our DNA. You know, people in North America have had a relationship with salmon that stretches back perhaps 15,000 years, you know, give or take a few thousand. In fact, there's recently a new paper that came out in a science journal, I think it's called Paleo America, that posits that it was really the salmon that led people across the Bering Land Bridge, as, you know, we've heard for all these years, mm-hmm. and down the West Coast before they spread out across the continent. So, you know, we've been chasing salmon a long time. We've been stewards of salmon populations in North America for thousands of years, and just being in the fish market and seeing these beautiful slabs of silver mounded like treasure on beds of ice, I think it gets everyone kind of salivating a little bit. You know, there's something about these fish that inspires us. So that's why I started at the marketplace. Now, of course, you know, Copper River Day has become a big deal in Seattle, and I guess you could say the Northwest in general. It usually happens in mid-May, and that's when the first shipment of Copper River salmon arrives from Alaska via Alaska Airlines on the tarmac at SeaTac to a, you know, waiting hoopla of reporters and TV cameras and all of that. And they usually have a, you know, a celebrity chef cook-off right there on the runway. And,
I didn't know
about
that.
There's all sorts of festivities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It seems all sort of out of proportion to what's really just a, you know, piece of fish, but these fish mean a lot. And, you know, the Copper River salmon have probably become the most famous brand name of wild salmon in North America. A lot of that has to do with marketing. They've undoubtedly got a wonderful piece of fish up there, and there are reasons for that that have to do with the fact that the Copper River is a glacial-fed river. It's very cold. It's very swift. It's fairly long. It's about 300 miles long. And so the fish that return to the Copper River have to have heavy stores of fat to make it to their spawning grounds. And of course, fat equals flavor when it comes to salmon. So they are no doubt a delicious piece of fish. On the other hand, they've done a wonderful marketing job up there. And also, they've worked very hard to make this sustainable so that year after year, commercial fishermen can go out and catch these wonderful fish and ship them to the fresh market instead of off to canneries, which actually earns them more money.
Well, from the excitement of Pike Street Market, then you take us down to the Columbia, where it's a little bit different story from the wild Alaskan fish. Tell us a little bit about what currently is going on along the Columbia and what the spring run is like, and what is it like for the native people along the river?
If the Copper River salmon are today's most famous sort of brand name salmon from coast to coast, then for most of history, human history in North America, that is, the most famous salmon was actually from the Columbia River, the Big River, as it's known to Native Americans. And this was because, first of all, the runs in the Columbia were enormous. They also, the Columbia is a huge sprawling river, and some Chinook salmon pushed, you know, more than 1,000 miles upstream and just really had incredible stores of fat. And I'm thinking specifically about the spring Chinook that enter as early as February, and they have to hold for months upriver, sometimes, you know, deep into the Snake River Basin, well upriver of the mouth. And those fish were the fish that were targeted by Native Americans up and down the Columbia. And people, in fact, came from as far away as the Great Plains to trade for those fish. So, you know, that the epicenter of the salmon universe for hundreds, if not thousands of years, was a place called Chulalo Falls, which is not far from the modern-day mouth of the Deschutes River. It's on the eastern side of the Columbia River Gorge, about roughly 200 miles from the mouth. So, you know, you would think that the epicenter would be somewhere right on the coast, mm-hmm. but in fact it was inland, and there were these falls there, Chulalo Falls, and the falls were an impediment to salmon. They right. could get over them, but it was a place where they stacked up, mm-hmm. and Native Americans would dip net salmon.
All different from tribes, from coming from all
right,
over.
Right, from many different tribes, mm-hmm. and, you know, they had these precarious platforms built on the basalt cliffs there,
I've
where
seen
the
that
river
picture.
Was sort of a choke point, and they could net enough salmon, a family could net enough salmon there to last them for a year. So it was an important subsistence fishery, and of course it was also an important place to go and trade. And so when Lewis and Clark came down the Columbia, you know, in the early 1800s, they referred to it as the Great Mart of the West, and it's also been referred to as the Wall Street of Indian country.
I think, listeners, you're getting an idea about the depth of storytelling and history and archaeology that you're going to find in this book, as well as just stories about some tremendous characters. Langdon, I'd like you to talk a little bit about one of these people. Let's go up to Cordova, find out about the life of a gill netter.
Right. So I traced the famous Copper River salmon from Pike Place Market sort of in the reverse way back to where they originate in the town of Cordova, Alaska, which is right near the mouth of the Copper River. And I made a few trips up there and got to know some of the gill netters who work outside the mouth of the Copper River. And so there are a number of different ways to commercially fish for salmon. You have trollers who are actually baiting hooks and fishing for them out in the ocean. You have purse seiners, which are dropping these sort of big nets that they pull up almost like the drawstrings of a purse and will catch huge amounts of salmon, most of those going to the canneries. And then you have gill netters. They're the ones that are working out in front of the Copper River. They're laying out these long nets that hang about 20 feet down, almost like a curtain in the water, and the fish are snared on their way to the spawning ground. And so those are the fish that are caught and immediately, you know, shipped south to Seattle and elsewhere to then sort of spread through the country, the famous Copper River salmon, mostly sockeye with some kings as well. But the sockeye fishery is the main fishery. And I went out with some gill netters and helped them. And it's really exciting because it kind of, there is a recreational fishing aspect to it. I mean, you really have to understand how the fish are thinking, and you have to, you know, have a great understanding of tides and water depth and mm-hmm. wind and all the different factors that go into catching a fish, whether you were doing it with, you know, a spinning rod or with a big, long, you know, 900-foot gill net. It's kind of the same.
I learned a lot from many episodes in your book, but also the expression corking I'd never heard before, and the competition
right.
between what the gill netter called the Russians, which were really Alaskans from Nanilchik and different settlements north of Homer. So that was a fascinating episode as well. I'm talking to Langdon Cook. He's the author of his most recent book. It's called Upstream, Searching for Wild Salmon from River to Table. And believe me, he goes all up and down the western coast to tell this story. Langdon, I'd like you to turn now to a place that's not quite as wild and wonderful. It's kind of from the mountaintop down to the valley. Let's go to the Central Valley. And can you read a little bit from your book about your day with Renee Henry?
Certainly. And just to sort of give a little preamble, you're right. It was important to me to really travel throughout Salmon Country to tell this story. And people don't realize that California once hosted epic runs of salmon. And in the Central Valley, which now, by some estimates, feeds Americans with maybe a third of what they eat, that valley, which is about 450 miles long, is fed by two faucets, the Sacramento River and the San Joaquin River. And this area has been so irrigated that in some years, less water flows through the San Joaquin River than has been promised to farmers. So I go down there and I meet up with an ecologist named Renee Henry, who becomes a recurring character in the book. He is sort of one of the points of optimism. And I try to, although I, you know, talk about all the different obstacles facing salmon in the new millennium, I also try to show where there are points of hope.
Yeah,
and Renee Henry definitely embodies that. So at one point, we went and took a snorkel survey. That's where you actually float downstream in a wetsuit, and you're snorkeling, and you're counting salmon nests as you go. Nests are also called reds. And so this particular passage takes place on the Yuba River, which is a tributary of the Feather River, which is a tributary of the Sacramento. So at this point, we've just snorkeled a section of river where we're too late. All the fish are spawned out, and we're just seeing dead carcasses. I didn't need a fisheries ecologist like Renee Henry to tell me we were too late for this stretch of river. The salmon were already gone from the riffles and stacked in the sandy bottoms of pools where currents had arranged their spawned out carcasses, pale white and stiff with rigor mortis, into morbid formations that were at once grotesque and beautiful. Suckers fed on them greedily like inheritors at a wake. The shapes of smaller fish hovered on the periphery, barely visible and always close to shelter, no doubt taking advantage of this feast when an opportunity presented itself. These were young salmon, hatched in the spring, and their presence went a long way toward answering the question, why do Pacific salmon die after spawning? So the next generation can live. A few jacks scooted by too, looking for live females on nests. These were precocious males, smaller than fully adult salmon, but still able to spawn. Returning to the river a year or two earlier than the rest of their cohort, they were a hedge against disaster, nature's insurance policy. Renee was reassured to see all these variations of the salmon life cycle, spawned out adults, jacks, and juveniles in one stretch. This was what you should see in a working system. We explored a few more pools with the same results, each of them decorated with carcasses. You had to admire these fish even in death, especially in death. A spawning run is a suicide mission, the biological imperative a toe tag. Here in California, the rallying cry of spawn till you die was complicated by a litany of obstacles that, in Renee's view, made the Columbia Basin to the north seem almost functional. Yet a few wild salmon continued to hang on after decades of abuse, and this tenacity, this failure to go quietly, was setting the stage for a showdown. As we bobbed in the slow current, Renee talked excitedly through his snorkel. The fish are on a downward trajectory and doing everything they possibly can, he said. The same can't be said for us. We need to do more. We all need to work together. This is Renee's worldview in a nutshell. Yes, he's a scientist, but his true calling is in the art of building bridges. Every day he has to insert himself between warring factions of people, farmers, ranchers, urbanites, environmentalists, and try to coax them into taking a shared responsibility for what happens on the landscape, to help them see commonalities rather than differences. Though hard science is his vocation, research, data, peer-reviewed hypotheses and conclusions, it's the softer science of the sort utilized by his wife, a psychologist and counselor, that he finds more useful in some ways. The ability to talk to people, to find common ground, to work through problems with nothing other than a conversation. He's also ungoverned by the conventions, the walls, you might say, that typically separate the object of study from the studier. Pacific salmon culture in North America is a dance between fish and humanity. For that dance to continue, the human partner needs to pay attention to nature's music. What's more, the human partner might need to take some dance lessons from the salmon themselves, which thrive on diversity, adaptability, and resilience.
Let's hear it for Renee Henry. That's a wonderful reading. Thank you for sharing it with us, Langdon. And you'll read more about this incredible character and also a real live living person. Join him in those meetings. Join him around the table and so many other places where during the course of this book, Langdon brings us, you know, kind of up close and personal to his life and the lives of many others, fishermen, foodies, people that are fighting environmental battles, and people just out there having fun fishing. That's why this book is such an enjoyable read. So I don't want to leave without mentioning our near and dear characters that are in the book. And you go up to Lummi Island as well and meet some reef netters and Riley Stark. Tell us a little bit about the archaeology of Lummi Island and salmon fishing.
Well, like Renee Henry, who offers some hope on the science front, Riley Starks is a character who also offers some hope, but he's offering it on the commercial fishing side of things. For the last 100-plus years, we've been fishing these salmon runs intensively on the West Coast, and we've been overfishing them to a certain degree. And, of course, there are all sorts of other problems that the salmon are facing. And the question is, are we going to have commercial fishing in the future? Now, Renee Henry would tell you that scientists like him, that they want these commercial fishermen to be able to continue this age-old occupation into the future because it's really one of our last connections to the world of wild food. Now, let me tell you a little bit about what Riley is doing. He's fishing in a very different manner. It's called reef netting. And reef netting has actually been around for centuries. It was a specialty of tribes in northern Puget Sound and southern Vancouver Island in that area. And basically, the reef net is a big deception. It's a net that traditionally would have been woven with beech grasses and nettles and that sort of thing. And it hangs in the water, making a sort of funnel. And the salmon are migrating, and they migrate right into the funnel. And the funnel narrows and also brings the fish up in the water column so they're in a tight school when they arrive at the Indian canoes at the end. And that's where actually another net is waiting to hoist them up out of the water. Well, these days it's done with some more modern gear, like a couple of barges with a nylon net strung behind them. But really the effect is the same. It's a deception. The thing that's amazing about this style of fishing is that once the fish have been hoisted up in the net, they are sort of funneled into a live tank on board, where they swim around and they swim off the lactic acid buildup, which is sort of part of the trauma of their capture, which takes place in the space of just a couple of seconds. And by swimming that off, they're a better cut of meat. But also, while they're swimming around there, the fishermen can then go and sort them and see if they've caught any stocks that might be endangered. So I went up and I fished with Riley Starks a number of times in Lummi Island, where they're still doing this. On a couple of occasions, they caught Chinook salmon. Well, in Puget Sound, Chinook salmon are listed on the endangered species list. And these Chinooks were easily identified among all the other sockeye that they caught. And the fishermen just hoisted them right overboard, and they swam off on their merry way, perhaps to spawn in tributaries that, you know, maybe only had a few wild king salmon left. So it's really important that we're able to select for these kind of fish. But with all other fishing methods, it's impossible to do that. Whether it's gill netting or purse seining or trolling, you can't put the fish back if they happen to be bycatch that you don't want. With reef netting, you can. And so Riley Starks believes that this is a very sustainable way to fish, and also that it produces the best piece of salmon that you could possibly eat. And, of course, there's a premium for that. His salmon fetch a pretty nice price, but there are chefs all over the country that are clamoring to buy these reef net fish. And, in fact, you can now go to, like, a Patagonia store and buy their pink salmon, which have been smoked. And pinks are the most numerous salmon in the Pacific. And for years, they've only been thought of as sort of a cannery fish.
Mm-hmm.
But Riley Starks is trying to change that. He's trying to interest people in pink salmon. And sort of the first step there is to smoke them and get them into consumers' hands. But he hopes that one day these pinks will also be just like big slabs of king salmon, you know, on ice at Pike Place Market.
That was really an inspirational chapter, as, you know, you talk later on about the humpies, the fish of the apocalypse, so to speak, as being the ideal smoking fish. And you're talking about your own fishing on the Duwamish. We kind of think, oh, that's an EPA site. How can you possibly be catching fish?
Right. I call those my Superfund salmon.
Your Superfund salmon. I'm trying to say that we go to Lummi Island, we go to the Duwamish, we're somewhere on the north coast of Oregon. And of course, you can't leave us without talking about the Elwha and the Glines Canyon Dam and what's happening to the fishery there. So that's really your closing chapter, and I felt pretty happy about that. As we leave you, tell us a little bit about what's going on the Elwha.
Taking down those two dams on the Elwha really needs to be celebrated. And it's a milestone for our region. And it also shows just how resilient nature really is. As one of the characters says in that chapter, if you just give nature a little room, it comes back. And that's certainly the case with the Elwha. As soon as those two dams were taken down, we saw Chinook and Steelhead repopulating the river. And now Coho and Pinks and Chum as well. It's been an incredible science experiment. The signs are very good.
So you have been listening to Book Lovers Cafe, and this is a program for everyone who hasn't read everything. And today we were pleased to talk to Langdon Cook, talking about his book Upstream, Searching for Wild Salmon from River to Table. Thank you again, Langdon, for joining us. Join me next time to talk more about books and authors. I'm your host, Chris Wilson, and I'd like to thank Mike Schlexer, who's here in the booth with us today, the engineer and the editor of this program. Thank you. See you next time.
The cool river sweeps the wild, wide ocean. Yes, boss, the government handshake. Yes, boss, the crusher of language. Yes, boss, Mr. Stillwater, the face at the edge of the bank with the